Hello and welcome to the Everyday Adventure Podcast. My name is Nikki Bass and I will be bringing you thoughts and ideas and hopefully some inspiration on how to build more adventure into your everyday life. So today I am thrilled to be speaking to Chris Branigan. Chris is an army officer and father of three who, in July of last year, set off on a 700-mile barefoot march across the UK in order to fund research and development for a gene therapy to help his daughter, Hastie. So I was following Chris on social media whilst he was carrying out his challenge, and I was absolutely blown away by not only his sheer grit and determination in making it through, but also by his willingness to be open and vulnerable about the toll it was taking on him from a psychological perspective. And I think what Chris's story really illustrates that actually it's not about being superhuman, but that it's having that clarity of perspective and drive that goes such a long way to supporting us. So I am so delighted that he's agreed to come on the podcast and share his story with everyone else. I'm not going to say too much else because I think it's much more powerful to hear from Chris in his own words. But just to say, Chris, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. It's just absolute pleasure to have you here. I've talked a little bit about why you set off on this immense journey that you did. But if you wouldn't mind, obviously you've picked something that was exceptionally arduous and challenging, and for anyone who followed your journey would have just seen, you know, what you encountered and probably not even the half of it. So I was just wondering, why did you choose to go barefoot across the UK? And yeah, tell us a little bit more about your motivation and your purpose.
First of all, thanks very much for having me, Nikki. It's great to be on your show. Why barefoot? I think that's the question I get asked more than anything else, and I'm still not sure I have a really good answer for that yet. But as you said, we've got a little girl called Hastie. She's 8 at the moment, and she has a really rare condition called Cornelia de Lange syndrome, or CDLS for short. And when the doctor told us, you know, she has this condition, the first thing I asked naively was, what can we do? You know, what medicines do we need? What doctors do we need to see? What are the next steps? And she just told me, nothing. There's nothing you can do. This is caused by a single gene mutation. And there's nothing you can do to correct the genome. And that just totally destroyed us, I think, as a family, because we couldn't accept that there was nothing we could do. And Hastie was having so many medical issues and complications, so many challenges. And we did the only thing we could do. And we just read and read and read. And finally, after speaking to loads of doctors, I mean, dozens of doctors all over the world, the ones we managed to engage with and get to look at this problem said, you know, you could create a gene therapy for CDLS, you know, but it'll cost a huge sum of money and it'll be complicated. And we realized that there was something we could do. And we immediately did, I think, what any parent would do. And then we just got after it and we just started chasing it. And we set up a charity. We started fundraising at the start of the year in January, February. We raised £150,000 against a target of £2.5 million.
Wow.
Which was a lot of money to raise, but still far away from our target. And we thought, this is good. You know, we're making progress. We've got momentum. And then lockdown just struck and our fundraising just stopped. You know, and we fought really hard to keep things going, but we just couldn't raise money. You know, it was such a chaotic time. People were worried about their jobs and, you know, their families and schooling and homeschooling, all the challenges we were living through as well. So we were constantly worried, what are we going to do to get this going? And we knew we had to do something like massive to grab people's attention and, you know, get them to look at what we were doing. And I remember just sitting with my wife and we're thinking about this. And I said, look, you know, Land's End Jungle Groups is iconic. Why don't we do something like that? And she said, yeah, but people do that for fun. You know, people take a month off work and like cycle Land's End Jungle Groups. That's not going to work. No one's going to donate for things that people do for fun. And I said, I'll tab it. You know, I'll carry kit, you know, military kit on my back. I'll carry my one-man tent. I'll just sleep rough. You know, I'll just make it happen. And she said, I don't know if that's still enough. And I don't know where it came from, but then I said, look, why don't I do it barefoot? And she said, could you do that? Is that even possible? And I asked a friend, I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it barefoot. And he said, no way. It's utterly impossible. Your feet would be destroyed. You just couldn't do it. It's impossible. And that's when I made the decision. I knew that if we were going to achieve something big, huge, people would have to think, what? What is he doing? That's crazy. And be able to grab their attention and hold it. And I live to regret it because it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life, if I'm honest.
I was going to say, I mean, did you have any idea of the, because it's one thing to have the idea and go, yeah, that's what I'll do because I grab attention. I mean, I guess to what extent did you have an idea of the scale of what you were taking on when you started? Or maybe, I mean, did that help that in a way that you didn't?
Totally naive. And a combination of naivety and really bad planning, brought it all together.
Brilliant.
I just thought, I'll do it, I'll prep, I'll do some barefoot walks, some barefoot runs, it'll be okay. And I did about a dozen, I think, in advance. And I thought, this is okay. I'm getting used to this now. But I was subconsciously, choosing all the best road surfaces, places that were flat and easy to walk on. So I thought, about this. And my planning was really bad. I hadn't trained with enough weight. I hadn't realized that the road surface was going to be worse. I was sort of training after work in the evening when it was cool, not at 1 in the afternoon when it was 37 degrees outside and it would cook your feet on the tarmac. So all of those meant that I started with real enthusiasm, glad to get started. I'm doing something positive now. We're going to make this happen. And within, I think, 36 hours, I turned 180 degrees and become panic because I just in so much pain so fast that I wasn't sure if I'd be able to cope for the rest of the journey.
Gosh, I almost hesitate to ask my next question because, I mean, just from what you've said, the challenges from the offset, and just like I said, for anyone who did see the photos of your feet and just the sheer physical intensity of what you were doing. But I think what was the greatest challenge that you encountered? I mean, what was the thing that really floored you? And in a way, maybe the thing that you're also proudest that you managed to find a way through.
Oh, I think, the destructive effect it had on my feet was obvious. Anybody who saw the photographs will have seen that I had open wounds on both feet. The skin was just coming off. I had infections. Doctors, after 2 weeks, said, told me when I went to A&E, you need to stop. They give me crutches and bandage my feet up, so heavily. They said, this is madness. You're going to damage yourself permanently. But that wasn't the greatest challenge. The greatest challenge by far was mental, because everything in my body was telling me to stop. When it was too hot and my feet were burning on the ground, when I was walking on open wounds on sort of gravel path, your mind focuses very acutely on the pain, and in a loud voice says, you need to stop. You need to just, this is madness. You're going to break yourself. And it gives you lots of reasons why you should stop. So that for me resulted in, sleepless nights. I couldn't sleep straight through a single night. Even though I was exhausted and I had a sort of calorie deficit and I was losing weight, I woke up 3, 4 times every night in a cold sweat, worrying about the next day. And every morning I woke up, I would think, I can't believe I have to do this again today. So I was constantly sort of fighting these internal demons. And I came up with all kinds of strategies to overcome them over the days, without even realizing it. When I was in pain, I had this green scarf, which I'm wearing now, around my neck. And I just used to put it in my mouth and just growl and just keep running, even though I was in agony. Did the times tables over and over in my head just to distract myself. And, I came up with three rules. The first one was it was okay to take a rest. If I felt like I was on the verge of just collapsing or giving up, I would just have a rest and kind of break that sort of horrible mental state. I never ever thought about going 700 miles or even to the end of the day. My objective was always to get to like a tree that I could see in the distance or a corner. And I thought, if I can get there, I'll be okay. It'll be okay when you get there. I was sort of fooling myself. And then finally, I just kept thinking why I was doing it. I'm thinking this isn't a, like a phys session. I'm not just like doing PT. I see, can't stop having this condition. And being able to choose to stop was a luxury. that I wouldn't allow myself to have. So I just had to keep going.
Gosh, that's amazing. Because it's interesting, isn't it? It's sort of a combination of in the moment strategies, but then, like you said, having that overriding purpose that in the end you're able to go back to in those moments, I suppose, and just go, okay, this is why I'm doing this. And I mean, yeah, just shows how powerful and how powerful our minds are, I guess, in terms of being able, like you said, finding a way through. I mean, there's the obvious benefit of why you were trying to do that. And I know you just raised an exceptional amount of money. It was phenomenal, particularly given, just as a reminder, it's hard. I mean, even now in November, it's hard to remember what it was like back in sort of June, July, and the conditions in which you were, you know, and so many charities have suffered so much this year. So to raise the sum you did was incredible. But then in terms of sort of the other benefits and maybe the unexpected benefits, the things that came out of it that you just never imagined, but that maybe have, that have stuck with you since, what would you say were those?
We started off of, as you said or alluded to, we had a big discussion about how much money we could hope to raise, and we thought, we'll put an ambitious target, let's try and raise £50,000. And I thought, if we can raise 30, actually I'd secretly be happy, but let's aim for 50. And when I finished and I took a screenshot on my phone that final night, as I finally lay in a bed next to my wife after a month and a bit away from home, we had raised £589,000, which just blew me away. But I think what I took away above all else was how kind people were. It totally changed my outlook on life, if I'm honest. I think we all go through life afraid to ask for help and afraid of feeling and presenting ourselves as vulnerable, you know. I grew up in the 80s where all my sort of childhood idols were Rocky and Action Man and He-Man. You had to be a big, strong man and never cry. But in fact, everywhere I went, I was, because I was on the edge of sort of being broken at almost every point, people just couldn't walk past me and not help me. I think after the third day, I didn't pay for anything. People brought me food everywhere I went. People offered me to stay in their homes. I met a man in Cobham, so near London, who had driven from Bristol. And I met him at the side of the road. He said, look, I've come all the way from Bristol because I just wanted to meet you and say, you know, what you're doing is incredible, you know, well done, and to give you this. And he handed me a check for £1,000. Just, you know, what do you say? You know, he could have even donated that online, but he did a 5-hour round trip to hand me that in person. So what I've taken away is that if you're really struggling, you only need to ask for help. People will work all day and all night to help you if they know you really need help. People are genuinely amazing, and you just have to ask, you know. And we live in an age where it's easy to think that everything is going to hell in a handbasket if you watch the news or read Twitter, but it's just not like that. You know, people will help.
That's incredible. And like you said, to have something like that, that stays with you. I think particularly this year where we've been so detached from other people and distanced in lots of ways, to actually see that in person. Wow. I mean, that story is just amazing. That's given me shivers.
And there were loads like that, Nikki. Mm. The other thing I'd say is that, I don't know, I became a bit like a magnet for people. And I was really confused as to why that was the case. People came out, I must have met 200, 300, 400 people a day and spoke to most of them. If it was for 10 seconds or 5 minutes or half an hour, it didn't matter. And loads of people told me what was going on in their lives. I remember on a cycle path on the way to York, I met a woman who told me she was having problems in her job and she felt she was being treated unfairly and wasn't getting ahead. And I couldn't figure out why she was telling me really at the time, but I think I was a safe person to speak to because I was going through my own problems as well. And I met another family on day 4 in Plymouth, and they lost their little boy at 8 years old. You know, people everywhere are going through these terrible things at work, at home. And I think when you're vulnerable and you talk about them, people open up and can help and support each other. And it's just changed the way I think about things and think about people.
And like you said, that willingness to be vulnerable and open and how,
Yeah, that actually that allows so many other people to do it too. I mean, that's incredible.
Again, I slightly hesitate to ask the next question because obviously what you've done, and I can imagine it probably took your feet a hell of a long time to recover from what you put them through. But I mean, what's next either in your journey or what do you hope for going forward, I suppose?
So next steps, well, I'm not sure. I think when we started, as I said earlier, we started literally with a hope and a prayer. You know, two parents, myself and my wife, we just said, we have to do this. We knew we had to set up a charity. We had to start fundraising. We had to, you know, convene a scientific advisory board. We had to work with a lab. You know, we had to project manage the whole thing. And we have no experience in any of those things. But we just knew that we had to try. And ever since that day, you know, we've been just living from day to day, week to week. You know, I'm planning as far ahead as we can while holding down two full-time jobs. And, you know, to think that in 12 months, what we've achieved, I think we've raised almost £750,000 now. We're working with a world-class laboratory who are really confident that they're going to create a gene therapy for us. You know, our focus is squarely on continuing the fundraising effort because while we've raised quite a lot of money and that pays for the research, which will prove that we can create the gene therapy, giving it to children so they can actually benefit from it, being able to actually give it to Hasty, will cost another £2 million.
Wow.
So what's next? I'm not entirely sure, but we're going to continue to push because, you know, it's not just for Hasty, it's for all those other parents who have kids that have CDLS and all the ones who are coming behind us who haven't had the diagnosis yet or haven't had the baby yet that's going to have CDLS because they're all coming. It's totally random. And I went through my life up until Hasty was born thinking that bad things happen to other people. And then one day, a totally random Thursday, I sat down on a geneticist's plastic chair in front of her desk. And she gave me news that turned my world upside down. And I don't want anybody else to be told there's nothing you can do. I want them to be told the bad news and then to be told that there is a treatment. Someone's created a treatment which you can have and that will transform your child's life.
Yeah, well, hopefully, yeah. And I mean, I know that part of your mission really has been about raising awareness as well. You know, about Cornelia de Lange syndrome, but also about rare diseases in general. And like you said, how little is known about them unless your life happens to be directly touched about them. And that's certainly something that struck me when I think when I came across your journey and your story, that actually, yeah, we live in a bubble until something touches us directly. And then you realize how that actually, like you said, your whole world can change, but that also, I suppose, from what you've experienced, how much support and how much people do want to know. And it's just, yeah, putting the word out there. And obviously, as you continue with your fundraising efforts, if there's anything that we can do to support this, you want to come back on, then we'd love to have you. I suppose just finally, because it's a question that I ask all my guests, is if somebody's listening to this and they have their own particular purpose or their own reason why they want to take on an adventure, whether it is big, whether it is small, whatever reason, from your experiences over the last year, what's the one piece of advice you'd give them?
One piece of advice.
Well, and no one ever gives me one piece, by the way, so you can expand it if you need to.
But also forewarn you that I'm terrible at giving advice. I think in my case, the biggest obstacle I had was before everything started, I was really worried about doing anything, you know, about walking and doing something that was going to be bring me to sort of public attention or, you know, do something that was really obvious. I was worried that no one would see me or care and I would feel foolish that I was just like walking around on the British countryside with a big sign on my back. And for that reason, when we were planning it, I procrastinated a lot, you know, and I put it off. I did the easy things, you know, I had, oh, I've got to take kids to school and I've got to make this video and I've got to do this email. And I avoided doing the task that I was really dreading. But my wife pushed me into it. So I think my advice would be get after it, tell people early that you're going to do it and then you're absolutely committed. The fear of not following through will make sure you get after whatever it is you're trying to do, and get people to help you. You know, you don't have to do these things alone. The only reason my barefoot journey was at all successful was because I had my wife behind the scenes doing all the hard work. You know, she supported me. She gave me great advice. When I was at my lowest point, she would get on the phone and just say, "You're okay, you know, keep walking, keep running, keep talking," you know. And little did I know, but she was also coordinating people behind the scenes. You know, she'd say, "You know, Chris is having a bad day, you know, go and talk to him, go and talk to him." And, you know, having that support behind the scenes was priceless for me. So I'd say get support and just do it.
Incredible. Thanks so much, Chris. If people want to find out more about Hope for Hasti, about your journey, where can they go?
So if they just Google Hope for Hasti, which is spelled H-A-S-T-I, they'll find our Facebook page, our Instagram page, and our website, and they can follow our journey in any of those and get involved in some of our fundraising challenges, or just watch and share is really helpful.
Brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. I can't emphasize that enough to have you on the show, Chris. And I wish you all the very best of luck with your ongoing fundraising. And like I said, if we can support you anyway, obviously we'll continue to do so. Thank you so much and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Nikki. Thanks for having
Cheers.
Me.
Bye.
So just listening back on my conversation with Chris, it was recorded a couple of months ago, probably 3 months ago now. And I was still absolutely floored by his honesty and his genuine depth of feeling about the response to what he did and really how he managed to achieve what he did. And I just wanted to pick up on the point he made about vulnerability, because I think this is something that we still wrestle to a greater extent. On the one hand, I think the conversation around vulnerability and our willingness to be vulnerable and ask for help for other people has opened up so much. And probably, you know, even in the last 2 or 3 years, really, it really has widened. But I think it hits a barrier when it confronts our perception of ourselves as what I call the tyranny of shoulds, that somehow we should be able to do things alone, that we should be able to cope, we should be able to manage, and that it's still somehow taboo to show what we may perceive to be weakness. And, you know, I know probably a lot of you will follow the work of Brené Brown and know that sort of the phenomenal work that she's done in helping to highlight just how much of a strength being vulnerable is. And I think what Chris illustrated so beautifully is actually what being vulnerable really does allow you to do is to properly connect with other human beings. Because when we try to show ourselves in a certain life, or when we feel that we've got to hide what we consider to be our flaws or our failures, it puts up a barrier to other people because we're not really allowing them to see us as we truly are. And then that means that we ourselves can end up feeling isolated or lonely or disconnected. And so the thoughts I'd like to leave you with today is just around, what does being vulnerable mean for you? What does it take for you to feel comfortable being vulnerable? And actually, have you experienced those times when you have shown up as your true self, or as in an open way, and really felt that sense of connection as well? I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Like I said, it was such a pleasure and a privilege to speak to Chris, I can't tell you. Going forward, if you'd like to connect with me, I'd love to know what you thought of the episode, how you found it, how you found the podcast. Please do get in touch. I'm on Instagram, Resilience at Work. You can contact me via my website, resiliencework.co.uk, or you can join us on Facebook in the Everyday Adventure Club. Otherwise, I will be back next week. I've got another incredible guest for you, and I look forward to seeing you then. Take care. Bye.